The way that we choose to participate here is something that is of a great importance and will have, it's really the only way that we can do it. It's the thing that's going to have the impact. And I think, like you're saying,
Right. But that's not the reason to do it. The reason to do it isn't that it's going to have an impact. I was thinking about this the other day as I went to great inconvenience to put an apple core in the compost rather than the garbage. And I mean, you can recycle all of your beer bottles and do all that kind of stuff, but you know what is that? As or you say you use fewer plastic bags, because you've read about that. Did you read about that enormous, hundreds of miles long slick of plastic in the Pacific Ocean?
Yeah, I have heard about some things and the garbage in the ocean
Well,
in general.
right. So, but there's this feeling, and this is related to the despair, where it's like, I can never use another plastic bag in my whole life, but is it really going to make a difference? And the answer is, rationally speaking, is no. It's not going to make a difference. Your contribution is not going to make a difference. And that's why there's got to be another reason to do it. That has nothing to do with your calculations of how big a difference it'll make and how much it'll reduce your ecological footprint. And so the answer that works for me is the reason that I recycle that apple core is because it feels really good, because I'm in love with that apple core and it wants to go back into the soil, and it's a personal relationship. I do it feels good because there's really no other way except for self-forcing.
Yeah, I get you. I get you. The thing that I recognize with this, and I'm sure it's your experience too, is that when we do what feels most appropriate to us, just in the moment to moment, day to day choices that we make, that ends up kind of having a wider effect, a synergistic effect, because now we're.
Yeah, in ways you can't even predict.
Yes, and then in that way, those small things do kind of reach out. And I think you're right that there are more and more people that are trying and finding that there are ways that they can, that the art in life is life itself. Everything that we do has the potential of being more beautiful. And choosing because it makes us more at peace, more happy, to do the things that we find to be a little bit more beautiful is a wonderful way to proceed along these lines and starting to appreciate the true life and beauty that surrounds us and fills us.
Yes, that's the bliss that's available all the time, everywhere. In the past, I used to enforce my good behavior by saying, okay, well, I ride a bicycle and I recycle and I do this and that and the other thing, so that means I'm good. And I would use those behaviors as license to approve of myself. I didn't realize that I was doing the same thing as my right-wing Christian fundamentalist friends, who had a different set of behaviors, a different set of voting patterns, and a different set of opinions, which they would use as license to approve of themselves. And then the next step, of course, is to use this approval and then the disapproval, if you disobey your principles, as a bludgeon, a carrot and stick to enforce good behavior. And feeling guilty, because to the extent that you were bad according to those principles, and feeling self-righteous to the extent that you were good. And then, it's kind of a self-control with guilt and conditional approval. And really, that's just buying into the same mentality that's destroying the planet, the mentality of control. And the alternative makes all of that control unnecessary. When you are, another way to say feeling at one with, when I talked about earlier, when you meet someone in the eye or with a tree or something, that feeling that, we're not really separate beings, that is called love. And love is an expansion of your identity to include another being. Because when you love another being, then something that happens to that other being is, it's as if it happened to you. In fact, it is happening to you. It's just the realization that it's happening to you. That's why, if something happens to my son, I mean, it hurts me too. And when we come into that consciousness, then it's just so effortless. We live in a different way, without this regime of self-control and self-punishment, and we see strategies of activism very differently then too, because a lot of activists will try to use the bludgeons of guilt on other people too. You should be ashamed of yourself. You're using more than your share. And how could those people be so greedy and driving their SUVs and stuff? That kind of mentality provokes a very valid opposition. But when we see activism as a matter of communicating, you know, here's how you could even be more blissful in your life. This is for you. I don't want you to have less in your life or to make do with less. But when activism comes from a ongoing, authentic, living understanding that, you know, I want to make people's life better for them right now, then people don't get defensive anymore.
That is absolutely lovely, and it kind of reframes the whole situation. And this is another one of the essential themes in your book that you're pointing out, that this idea that we can kind of control our way into a solution. Well, that's this old set of priorities that we've had in operation that hasn't worked very well.
No, it hasn't. So we're going to do the same thing, but even more, and it'll work now.
Well, and so what you're pointing out complements all the other themes in there so well, because it's a completely rearranged and transcendent approach, a much more inside-out approach, I guess you could reasonably say, that allows us to find solutions that kind of, as you were saying, do what you do because it truly makes you feel, you know, most happy and fulfilled. You know, make the choice according to what your own heart and soul would tell you is the best choice.
When I speak in front of audiences and lay this out, always I get, well, what if what you really want to do is to drive a race car or what you really want to do is to commit mass murder or something like that? I always get that response. What would you say to that?
What would I say?
Yeah.
Well, the thing I would say about it, it's probably resonant with where you would come from on that. It's that, if I'm making the choice from what truly makes me most happy, then what I'm going to be interested in, the thing I'm going to be interested in, is going to be something that's going to have a connection with the life that surrounds me as well. It's not going to be something that makes me happy if I'm putting all my attention and energy into something that's totally destructive. The thing I come back to is that thriving in ecstasy are not something that happens just for one person or for a select group. Ecstasy isn't ecstasy unless it's shared.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that magnifies itself through everything. I think springtime is the very best and most practical metaphor we have for that. When the warmth and the light comes, everything blooms. It all blooms together.
Yes. Yeah. And what I say to people is, like, it's basically what you're saying. I say, you know, no one really wants to do that. No one really wants to. No one really wants to commit mass murder. And if someone came to me and said, you know, I want to go out there and commit mass murder, I'd say, do it if you really want to. I would give them that permission. And maybe I wouldn't say it in those words, but whatever I said would come from a authentic understanding that that's not what they really want to do. And by giving people permission, yeah, do it if you really want to. You're giving them permission to not do it. I don't think anyone wants to do anything that humiliates other people and destroys the earth. But we think we have to. We think we can't afford to do otherwise. The phrase can't afford kind of hints at the force that's being applied to us, because basically when we say can't afford, it means it taps into survival anxiety. It means I can't. There's a gun being held to my head, so I have to make these phone calls to pursue, because I work for a collection agency, and pursue delinquent debtors, you know, but actually I would like to let them off the hook. You know, people's natural impulses. Now, you can always have examples of addiction and stuff, and that gets into my other work, the yoga of eating and the other work where I understand there's a concept of substitute desires, and the things that we think we want are substitutes for what we really want. What someone really wants is maybe connection. What they give themselves is television. What someone really wants is the sweetness of intimacy. What they give themselves is sugar. But that's a different conversation, I guess.
What we're really talking about ultimately is a different way for our attention to be focused. And that leads to a different kind of dynamic. And if our attention is going in a way where what we're really focused on, as you're suggesting, is what is most deeply fulfilling. If we're free to nurture the creativity and the art of life blooming everywhere, then the thing that would also give us great joy would be to find out what is needed most by those who surround us and helping them, giving it to them, supporting them in their own discovery of it. And in that way, then, we wouldn't be unconsciously nurturing all kinds of despair and dysfunction as we do right now with our very insular and isolated way of engaging with ourselves, each other, and the world. Different dynamic.
And it's happening around us, even though sometimes it seems that things are worse than ever. But the wave rears up highest before it crashes. On the beach, they rear up really high and they hollow out. And if you're lying there on the sand and you see it looming up over you, it looks like it's higher than ever, but it's actually about to crash.
That's kind of a metaphor. It's this moment for the immense amount of destruction and dysfunction that we see all around us.
Yeah, it's like, you know, things appear worse than ever, you know, but that's kind of I see it as the last gasp, in a way, of the old world.
Yes, I completely follow and concur. My own conclusion is exactly the same.
Which is actually, from like the ego point of view, that's no cause for comfort, because in the transitional period, as birth actually happens, you know, there will be people who will die. And it may be necessary for those of us who are in the role of midwives to, you know, things might happen. We might go to prison, you know, we might be killed in violence, who knows. There's no guarantee of personal security in all of this. But for the planet as a whole, it's a beautiful process that we're being born through.
Considering the fact that we're approaching, we've already gone through the year 2000, we're approaching 2012, and we're certainly seeing all signs of stress in the economy and with international relations. We're seeing a lot of signs that the things are getting much more intense and breaking down.
Yeah.
So we can't really say, nobody can say. I mean, I think there's some very insightful things that are coming out, your work included, that tell us about some of the deeper truth and so forth. But we still can't say exactly how this thing is going to shake out. I think we could see reasonably, like you've just articulated, that there is definitely a transition process, potentially very big, shake them up, turn things around, turn things over kind of a process is going on. And we can't see for certain how much grace will allow us to avert some of those things. It seems maybe perhaps we've managed to get past some of them gracefully already, but there are still many challenges ahead of us.
Right. And it's really not up. I mean, you know, I don't even spend too much time thinking about that. You know, for me, it's really simple. I just respond with the gifts that I've been given, pass them on whenever there's a call for them, whenever I can do anything that is needed, like put the apple core in the compost or say a word to somebody who's suffering. I mean, there's infinite chances. And I'm not saying I'm a particular saint at all, but it's just that there's always something to do that feels good. And that's my guide, what feels good and what I can create on any scale that's beautiful. And we all have such different gifts, you know. There's one thing I think of quite often. Sometimes I do interact with friends who are, you know, completely, they believe that we're basically on the Titanic and that we've already hit the iceberg and, you know, that we're all doomed. Civilization is sinking, and they have plenty of reasons why we're screwed. the more you read the environmental stuff, the scarier it is, you know. And then there's the political stuff and the fascist state and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so they make a very good case that, you know, it's already too late. And so I think, okay, if I was on the Titanic, what would make sense? There was, in the movie, there was one scene where the ship's going down and there's two frightened little children in the lower class berth. And the mother, she knows that the ship's going down and that they cannot possibly escape. So she reads them a story. And for those 10 minutes, it's okay for those children. There is so much suffering out there that there's, whether or not civilization is doomed, there is an endless supply of good, meaningful work to be done. And you can live your days in bliss if you just simply respond to those needs. It doesn't matter if the ship's going down or not. There's still plenty of children to read the stories to. And it's just not my responsibility. You know, so basically I just allow myself to respond to whatever needs that I come across, whatever opportunities that there are for me to give of my gifts, I take advantage of it. So I'm living in the new world regardless of what else goes on. Nothing can stop me from living in the gift. I call it living in the gift. And a lot of people are doing it. I've learned how from other wonderful people who have shown me by their example how to live blissfully. The new world can be here already. That's because a lot of people say, well, you know, this will be great when everyone else does it, but for now we're stuck here.
Well, and in that way, then you are already, as you point out, attending to that energy of heaven on earth, which from the time of Jesus and even before his time was something that was already here. And the wisest of the wise could feel it, see it, and live according to it.
Yeah, there are tons of people around today who are living heaven on earth. Usually it only happens after they've had their first heart attack or you know, something has collapsed their old world. But now it's happening to a lot of people at once. I mean, if you thought about like the epidemic of depression, you know, and chronic fatigue and the broader crises are invading people's lives, and life is falling apart for a lot of people right now. And that's going to birth them into bliss one way or another. Some of them have to die for it to happen, but there are many, many people out there. Every day I find people who teach me how to live.
That's beautiful.
If you picked up the reference to finding what would improve the lives of the people closest to us and meeting their requests well listened, the fact that people like to buy fair trade and that they give money to charities is a sign that, in contrast to the assumptions of the capitalist market, they're actually altruistically inclined to help all people in the world. David Corton has his own angle on this from a speech in Seattle in 2008. I hope you find it as uplifting as I did.
We're all aware of the crisis that's unfolding around us. Many of us have been anticipating it for decades. And now it's here. It doesn't give us much time, but people are beginning to wake up. Peak oil, climate change, financial collapse, and spreading social disintegration. They're all consequences of the deep cultural and institutional dysfunctions of our society. And the imperative to address them presents us with an epic test of human intelligence and creativity. And that's why we're here. Now, when I was a student in business school, my professors always told us, go for the big picture. You find a problem, you find something is going wrong. Okay, fix it. But always look upstream. Look upstream for the source of that problem. Where did that problem come from? And address the problem at its source. And that's very much what we need to be doing right now. The big picture of the human confrontation with the limits of our Mother Earth becomes crystal clear once we step back and take that look upstream. This big picture has three critical elements. The first element is environmental collapse, driven by a relentless growth in consumption and population. From the perspective of our Earth Mother, our human excesses have for millennia been little more than the normal nuisance one expects from young children. But somewhere around 1970, we passed a threshold. Our human consumption became more than a nuisance. It began to exceed what our mother could bear and began to threaten her very life. And we, of course, see the results in climate chaos, depletion of fresh water and fertile soils, the collapse of fisheries, the erosion of denuded forest lands, and melting ice caps. We're building up toxics in the water, soil, and air. In short, we are killing our mother and thereby ourselves. As a species, we have to grow up fast and accept our adult responsibilities. And the implications, once you see them, are pretty clear. I see a lot of folks here from my generation. I assume there's some Trekkies in the audience, Star Trek. You remember those scenes kept coming up in Star Trek? Scotty to Captain Kirk, life support's failing. Kirk to Scotty, shut down all non-essential systems and redirect all available resources to life support. There it is. The order for our times. No resources for war or extravagance. Focus all attention on the health of the crew and the life support system. No more throwaway stuff. No more economic growth for the rich. Our priority must be to grow our well-being rather than our consumption. Invest in peace, education, and health care rather than war. Invest in compact communities rather than suburban sprawl. Invest in local economies and environmental rejuvenation rather than shipping toys around the world and speculating in the global casino. Invest in sidewalks, bicycles, and bicycle paths and public transportation rather than cars and highways. Invest in education for living rather than advertising to get us to consume more. Now here's the kicker. We must eliminate exactly those forms of non-essential production and consumption that our economic and political systems are designed to promote. So that puts us into a little bit of a bind. Take a look at the second element, the second piece of the big picture. It's an unraveling of the social fabric of civilization that is a consequence of extreme and growing inequality. A world divided between the profligate and the desperate cannot long endure. It intensifies competition for Earth's resources, undermines the legitimacy of our institutions, and drives an unraveling of the social fabric of mutual trust and caring essential for healthy social function. In 2005, Forbes magazine counted 691 billionaires in the world. This year, only 3 years later, it counted 1,250, nearly doubling in 3 years. And it estimated their combined wealth at $4.4 trillion. $4.4 trillion. Now, as you know, $1 trillion is $1,000 billion. So you wondered where all this wonderful economic growth is going. That's where it's going. These are the people who get the big tax breaks. According to a United Nations study, the richest 1% of the world's people now own 51% of all world's assets. The poorest 50% own only 1% of those assets. And that, of course, is why we call them poor, because they don't own any assets. And when rich people own everything, there's nothing left for the poor to own. Consider. Poor family wants a small plot of land to grow some food. A billionaire wants that land for a 20,000 square foot vacation home he may reside in for no more than a few days a year. Guess who gets the land? They tell us economic growth is essential to lift the poor to prosperity. All too often, economic growth actually lifts the yachts and swamps the naked swimmers. Most growth in consumption in recent years has not been at the bottom where it's needed. It's been at the very top among the already super wealthy. Our real resources are shrinking. With whatever resources are left, the rich can easily buy them. Speaking of billionaires and their yachts, I love the quote from one clueless billionaire commenting on the rising price of oil. "Well, so it used to cost me $30,000 for a tank of diesel for my yacht. Now it costs me $60,000. It's no big deal." Of course, if you've got more than $1 million, it's not a big deal. For the super rich, if we run out of oil, there's always ethanol. Meanwhile, desperate mothers watch helplessly as their babies die for lack of food. We cannot grow our way out of poverty. The only way to end poverty and heal our social divisions on an already overstressed planet is through a redistribution of resources from rich to poor and from non-essential to essential uses. Now, we're not supposed to talk about redistribution. Can't you just hear the right-wing windbags? Hey, that Corton guy, he's talking about equity, redistribution. He must be a communist. Actually, let it be known that I'm a proud American patriot. I grew up with the patriotic story that the United States is a middle-class democracy without the extremes of class division that characterize other societies. That story once made us proud and made us the envy of the world. Of course, it's never been quite accurate, but it expressed a beautiful, widely shared human ideal that we must now reclaim. Equity is an essential foundation of true democracy and of our national ideal and self-image. Equity, it turns out, can even be defended on the grounds of rightful inheritance and property rights. Think about it in this frame. Natural wealth was created by our Earth Mother. Natural wealth was created by our Earth Mother and is therefore the common heritage of all her children, including non-human species. None of us has a right to abuse that wealth or to monopolize its use to the exclusion of our sisters and brothers. This brings us to the third element of the big picture. The governing institutions to which we give the power to set our priorities and our collective course. We might wonder how such injustice could happen in a world governed by democratically elected governments. I think you anticipate the answer. Our world is not governed by democratically elected governments. It is ruled by global financial institutions in the service of financial speculators who exchange trillions of dollars daily in search of instant unearned profits to increase the fortunes and the power of the richest people on the planet. These speculators bring down governments that displease them and buy and sell the largest corporations like commodities. By design and law, the defining priority and obligation of these governing institutions is to generate financial profits, to make rich people richer, in short, to increase inequality in a world in desperate need of greater equity. To this end, the corporations that rise or fall at the pleasure of the speculators assault our eyes and ears with advertising messages intended to get us, particularly those of us who already have more stuff than we need, to buy more stuff. That's the big picture. That's the background. This is why we have to be absolutely clear that tinkering at the margins is not going to get us where we need to go. Okay, change our light bulbs, drive a Prius instead of an SUV. We got a lot more than that to do. So what's this big picture overview tell us about what we need to do? Now, here's a key point. We're told that the changes that we talk about to save ourselves from environmental devastation will impose great hardship. So how much suffering will changing our ways impose? Well, for one thing, we're going to need to grow strong, caring communities in which we get more of our human satisfaction from caring relationships than from material goods. We'll need to end war as a means of settling international disputes and dismantle our military establishment. We'll need to reclaim the American ideal of being a democratic middle-class nation without extremes of wealth and poverty. And we'll need to encourage and support the rest of the world in doing the same. And to do all this, we will need to create democratically accountable governing institutions devoted to the well-being of people and nature. And let us be clear, there can be no trade-offs between justice and sustainability, happiness and democracy, because they are all inseparably linked. So does any of this sound like unbearable hardship? And exactly how is a more just distribution of resources going to hurt the poor? Now I'm going to say a lot more about fabricated cultural stories that obscure our ability to see the possibilities before us. But the story that protecting the planet will impose unbearable hardship is one of those fabricated stories. We've got to put it to rest. Now think about this question. Wouldn't it be nice if it turned out that the choices we have to make together, to survive together, are in fact the same choices we must make to create the world that most of us really want? And if it's about creating the world most of us really want, we should be able to just get together and make it happen. Wouldn't that be cool? So maybe we ought to start a conversation to find out what it is people truly want. Now, actually, that conversation began quite some time ago. One of the most profound experiences of my life was participating in the civil society portion of the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, in 1992. I was part of a gathering of some 15,000 people representing the vast variety of humanity's races, religions, nationalities, and languages. And our conversation centered on defining the world that we wanted to create together. Discussions were chaotic and sometimes contentious. But at one point, it hit me like a bolt of lightning. For all our differences, we all wanted the same thing. Healthy children, families, and communities with healthy natural environments, living in peace and cooperation. And not just for ourselves. We wanted it for everyone. Out of our conversations grew our shared dream of a world in which people and nature live in dynamic, creative, and ultimately cooperative and balanced relationship. The Earth Charter, which is the product of a continuation of that discussion, calls it Earth Community. Now, I've lived in a lot of exotic places. Ethiopia, Nicaragua, Indonesia, the Philippines, California, Florida, and even that other planet, Washington, D.C. I've experienced a lot of different kinds of people. As I reflect back on that experience, I realize that for all our differences, with the exception of a relatively few people who suffer from some debilitating psychological dysfunction, we are a lot more alike than we generally realize. so surprising. Most of us want to breathe clean air and drink clean water. We want tasty, nutritious food uncontaminated with toxins. We want happy, healthy children, loving families, and a caring community with a beautiful, healthy, natural environment. We want meaningful work, a living wage, and security in our old age. We want a say in the decisions our government makes. We want world peace. Is this too much to ask? And do you know anybody that doesn't want that? But you say, what about here in the United States? What about this division between red states and blue states? Well, if you look at the polling data, it turns out there are actually a whole lot more purple than we realize. For example, 83% of us believe that as a society, the United States is focused on the wrong priorities. Imagine that. Supermajorities of more than 80% want to give higher priority to the needs of children, families, community, and the natural environment. 72% of us agree that big companies have too much power. You begin to put the data together and you begin to realize that Americans want a world that puts people ahead of profits, spiritual values ahead of financial values, and international cooperation ahead of international domination. Now, I want you to notice something here. None of these values expressed here can be defined as specifically either conservative or liberal values. They are human values, deeply, widely shared human values. So what if all of us who live in this country are to wake up one morning and recognize that we are, in fact, one nation yearning for healthy children, families, communities, and natural environments? So where do we stand? Let's see some hands here. Anybody believe here that a society we're focused on the wrong priorities? Hot damn. Anybody here want to see more priority given the needs of children, families, communities, and nature? Whoa. Is there anybody here that thinks big corporations have too much power? Hey! We got a room full of psychologically healthy people. And I bet some of you came in here thinking that you were members of a fringe minority. We are the leading edge of a new national and global supermajority, and it is time to speak and act accordingly. Now, if we need more evidence about our commonality of humans and what we want, we might take a look at some of the recent scientific findings that actually tell us that our brains are in fact wired for compassion, caring, altruism, and cooperation. When we're engaged in such activities, we release our bliss hormone, a hormone released when we're being cooperative and generous or having good sex. Wow. So it turns out that most people everywhere, irrespective of skin color, religion, nationality, or language, are happiest when they're being helpful, loving, peaceful, generous, and cooperative. Isn't that stunning? Think of the possibilities. So what's our problem? Why are we in such a mess? Why didn't we long ago just get together to create the world we really want? What are the barriers to creating the world in which we measure our progress against a national happiness index rather than an index of how fast we're turning stuff into garbage? Well, perhaps corrupt politicians and greedy corporate executives come to mind. That's true. These folks certainly demonstrate that there are some seriously morally and psychologically challenged people in the world. And part of our problem happens to be that they're the ones that most often capture the headlines because they're the ones most inclined to engage in the ruthless competitive struggle required to get those positions at the top of the power structure. And then, of course, there are also those dysfunctional institutions we mentioned devoted to the concentration of wealth and power. These institutions tend to recruit ethically challenged leaders who share the values the institutions are devoted to serving. So this is all part of this dilemma that we face. Our biggest problem, however, is not either bad people or bad institutions. The problem way up there at the source of the stream is a bad story. A bad story that keeps running on an endless loop in our heads, telling us to get real because the world of our dreams is nothing more than a naive fantasy forever beyond our reach. You know the story. It may have been running in your heads the whole time I've been speaking. It is our human nature to be fearful, violent, greedy, and individualistic. Our well-being in this life depends on strong leaders with the will to use their police and military powers to protect us from the criminals, terrorists, and rogue dictators who threaten our way of life. We depend on the competitive forces of a free and regulated market to channel our individual greed to constructive ends. There is no alternative. It is in our nature. Our only hope for salvation is the promise that if we obey those whom God has appointed to rule in this life, God will reward us with paradise in the afterlife, in a place where people live in peace, harmony, and eternal bliss. We're supposed to wait to get to the world of our dreams. Don't even think about creating it here. Wow. But the story goes on. The discipline and competition necessary to achieve order in this life may bring pain and hardship to some, but it is all for the good, because the brutal competition of war and the unrelenting pursuit of individual profit builds character, drives innovation, and leads to greatness. This competition, violent and destructive as it may sometimes be, has been the key to human success since the beginning of time and ultimately works to the benefit of everyone. Whoa. Have you ever heard this story? How often do elements of this story run in our heads, telling us the world we long for really isn't possible? This debilitating story is also self-affirming because our media bombard us with stories of the violent, the greedy, and the individualistic, including many politicians and corporate CEOs celebrated for their political and financial success. So it's very easy to conclude that such people are representative of the best of our human nature rather than the pathological exceptions to the healthier human norm. I call this story the Empire Story because it is the foundation of 5,000 years of organizing ourselves into dominator hierarchies. Hierarchies of domination and abuse. The story legitimates the oppression of empire and denies the highest order potentials of our human nature. The potential which, if cultivated, that makes it possible for us to do things differently. The elements of this narrative are embedded in the stories most commonly heard from a great many economists, scientists, preachers, politicians, and historians, among others. We heard them in school, we hear them in church, We hear them on the media. Their constant repetition creates a kind of cultural trance from which we are now just beginning to awaken. A trance isn't new. It's held us captive to the most reptilian aspects of our human nature for the past 5,000 years. It drives the endless imperial cycle in which one empire vanquishes another and obliterates its accomplishments. The successes of those who achieve imperial dominion over their neighbors gives rise to monumental hubris and material self-indulgence until the reigning empire is so weakened by its own excesses that the more disciplined warriors of another tribe or nation easily vanquish it. Does anything here sound familiar? Where exactly is our beloved United States in this cycle? It's interesting. Times have changed. The fall of the American Empire seems destined to come not from any military invasion across our borders by some foreign army. It will come, rather, from our growing foreign debt and the purchase of our assets by the foreign sovereign wealth funds that hold that debt. So won't it be a rude awakening when we one day wake up to realize that we, the democratic, Christian, capitalist rulers of the world, have been reduced by our own hand to an economic colony of the Chinese Communist Party and a group of Islamic dictatorships in the Middle East? A sobering thought. But no one in power seems to notice, perhaps because their attention is focused on promoting wars in the Middle East and bailing out the high rollers who lost one of their oversized yachts gambling on subprime mortgages. Change begins with a new story that celebrates the best rather than the worst of what we are and what we can be. It's pretty straightforward. If we convince ourselves that we're innately brutal, greedy beings, and that this is all for the good, then we set ourselves a goal of perfecting our capacity for greed and violence, thus perpetuating the world of our nightmares. It's time to start filling our heads instead with a story that it is our nature to be caring and giving, and that this is all for the good, and therefore we properly set our sights on perfecting our capacity for love and caring and create the world of our dreams. That more positive story isn't particularly new. A young fellow named Jesus built quite a following for preaching it to large crowds of adoring fans some 2,000 years ago. Some of our most revered heroes, for example, Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., preached the same message and built powerful social movements. Okay, I know the question that you're about to ask. Didn't this guy Corton just say it's been this way for 5,000 years? And they crucified Jesus and they assassinated Gandhi and Martin Luther King. Why should we expect things to change now? It's over. The ice caps are melting. We're cooked. Here's the key to why now. For the first time since the first empires were formed in the lands we now call Iraq and Egypt, for the first time, we have both the means and the imperative to liberate ourselves from the story in our heads, break the cycle of domination, and live Earth community into being. It's the great work of our time, and some of us call it the great turning. The communications capabilities of the Internet provide the means to hold the global conversation needed to awaken ourselves from our cultural trance and to create global alliances for change that bring together people from all levels of society. It starts with local conversations that grow and merge through the Internet into global conversations. The global scale collapse of social and environmental systems provides the shared imperative to have that conversation, a conversation that is now already underway. For the first time since our earliest human-like ancestors walked the earth millions of years ago, we humans have the means and the imperative to engage this conversation on a global scale. We weren't born with the empire story in our heads. It is not in our genes. It got there because it is a constantly reoccurring theme of the cultural stories we turn to for answers for our most basic questions about ourselves and our possibilities. It got there from the economic, political, and religious institutions that perpetuate it and that reward those who serve its values by showering them with financial success and promoting them to positions of unaccountable power. Profound social change takes place when an important cultural story changes. And the impetus to challenge imperial rule rarely comes from within the institutions of empire. Democracy took hold when we replaced the story of the divine right of kings with the story that the powers of government derive from the will of the people. People of color and women won recognition of their full human rights only as the civil rights and women's movement successfully exposed the fallacy of the story that people of color and women are less than fully human. And now that we recognize the full humanity of all peoples, it opens us to a deeper understanding of what it truly means to be human and all the rich potentials of our human nature. The environment movement is replacing the story that nature is a dark and evil threat to be subdued, vanquished, and used for whatever purposes please us, with a story of Earth as a living being, the mother of life, a living spaceship. We're still working on many of these new stories, but those of my generation have experienced the enormous societal shifts that these changes in our cultural stories have wrought. In each instance, a new story has contributed to the larger process of the great turning of the human course from the dominator power of empire to the partnership path of Earth community. The propagandists of empire, who propagate empire stories, work at an inherent disadvantage because their success depends on suppressing our inherent natural desires for community, justice, and liberty. That's why empire has to pay them so handsomely for their service. The results they seek do not come naturally. Power of authentic stories is the source of civil society's ultimate power advantage. The stories of Earth community acknowledge and express our genuine desire to love and to be loved and to live in caring cooperative communities with peace and justice for all beings. Corporations command economic power. Governments command the coercive power of police and military. The power of authentic stories, however, ultimately trumps all other forms of power because these other forms of power depend on the stories that lend them legitimacy. Unlike the fabricated stories of empire, the authentic stories of Earth community resonate with what we know deep in our hearts to be true. And once we're clear that there is an alternative to the violent domination of empire, and that it is the world of our dreams, we can together reclaim the power we have yielded to empire and redirect it to the work of growing Earth community. Without our acquiescence, the dominator structures of empire collapse. As the Marcos regime in the Philippines collapsed, as the Soviet Union and the apartheid regime in South Africa collapsed, without a shot fired. Progressive talk show host Tom Hartman calls this process walking away from the king. How does it happen? It starts with a conversation. A while back, Cecile Andrews, our local Seattle author of The Circle of Simplicity, explained to me how the women's movement changed the story on gender and unleashed the long-suppressed power of the feminine. This started with discussion circles in women's living rooms, in which women came together to share their personal stories. And as each woman spoke her truth, a larger truth was revealed for all to see. The prevailing story, the prevailing cultural story that the key to a woman's happiness is to find the right man, marry him, and devote her life to his service, was not true. I see some women smiling. Now, absent that discussion that encouraged the sharing of the true stories, women whose experience failed to conform to the prevailing cultural story held themselves responsible for the failure. They assumed they were simply different and therefore in some way deficient. By breaking the silence to share their stories, they ended their isolation, rose above self-doubt, and came to realize that they were in very great good company of a great many other wonderful women. Many of them then lent their voices to a growing chorus of women in changing the cultural stories by which society had long defined women and their roles. Now, Cecile also noted to me the same process is involved in the voluntary simplicity movement. Through sharing stories about what makes us truly happy, we come to see the fallacy of the advertising story that material consumption is the key to our happiness. Once this fallacy is seen for what it is, we can enthusiastically share our stories of how we are each improving the quality of our lives by reducing the quantity of our consumption and gaining control of our time to do more of the things that make us feel fully alive. The power of authentic stories, told and retold by millions and ultimately billions of people, can trump the power of empire, and it begins with a conversation. And I bet some of you came in here thinking that you were members of a fringe minority. We are the leading edge of the new national and global supermajority, and it is time to speak and act accordingly.
They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good.
The media used for this episode are at www.unwelcomeguests.net/510. The show has a mailing list at www.altruists.org/unwelcome for anyone interested in giving feedback or otherwise helping the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. If you're not yet talking, I'd encourage you, if you feel ready to talk, to find someone close to you and share the ideas of this program with them. Let's be a part of this great conversation that David Corden talks about. Let's be one of billions rethinking the story of what it means to be human. Keep giving all you can.
Always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave